Hey yo, we about to tear it up. Yo,
break for break, break for break it down.
This right here is how we do it. Break it down.
It's the Breaking Actuals podcast. We break things down to the very last compound. My name is Sumit, a.k.a. the potty mouth of the South.
And my name is Chris Mitchell, a.k.a. the actual factual.
So listen, we're going to keep this very short.
Yes.
Because our guest is here and I don't really care about you. I don't really care for you because I have to act all greasy when we have guests involved. This is, I don't know what this is. When people have come to my house, I'm not like this.
I know.
But as soon as we get into a Zoom or a Breaking Actuals podcast, I get really, really greasy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is. I think it's some traumatic things in my life that I need to speak to my therapist about. But until then, We'll get to that another point. But we have a very special guest, a musicologist, a mediator, a conduit of the culture, someone whose bucket list, someone that we highly respect, someone who has respect within different genres of the culture. We're not talking hip-hop culture. We're talking funk. We're talking dance. We're talking house, techno, whatever you want to do, whatever you want to say. This person walks in with the red carpet rolled out, and he is with us here today on the Breaking Actuals podcast. Chris, take it on home from here.
Listen, ladies and gentlemen, this man has soundtracked many lives, including my own. I spent time in Brooklyn last year in the year of 2022, and I was in Brooklyn thinking, this is where DJ Spinner is. This is where he lives. I'm on his soil. Do you know what that means? Not only has he soundtracked lives, he's the reason why I see colors and I see life in BPMs. One of my favorite producers. People want to throw around the word underrated or willy-nilly. But this man is, his music is before its time. It's of its time. It's ahead of his time. And I was so nervous today because this conversation means so much to me. He has produced milestone moments in my life. You know, my relationship with my wife, you know, his music is a part of that. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, the internationally respected, locally exalted. He's been many places, but he's Brooklyn's own. DJ Spinner. How are you, sir?
Good, man. Much respect. Much respect. Pleasure to be here.
Sir, I I'm so excited. We have moments on this podcast where we speak to people who we love and respect most of the time, and then there's this people's bucket list that, you know, we set time aside for, like, you know, a couple of hours. These are the questions that we wanted to ask them for ages. And you are one of those, you know, those people that we have a certain reverence for. That's the word, reverence. DJ Spinner, reverence. So thank you for taking the time to be here today.
Yes, sir.
So how man, you I'm doing, gonna pass the mic to you.
Yeah. How you doing, Mr. Spinner?
I'm good, man. I can't really complain. You know, I have a lot going on as always, and yeah. I'm just trying to stay healthy, strong, you know, devoted to the music like I always am. And,
facts.
Keeping it moving.
Wonderful. You were just here not so long ago, actually.
Yes. Southport.
That's right. A little festival out there. Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And we know we'll talk about your relationship with the UK in terms of your career, but the people that you have and the people that you have here, some are mutual and some aren't. But you know, you are heavily respected on these shores, on this island. You are heavily respected. But I want to take it back as we start the interview to Panama, to Panamanian household, early musical influences. Talk about growing up. I'm Southeast Asian, right? Chris is Jamaican. And sometimes a lot of similarities in growing up in a what we call ethnic minority household. But talk about that, but also how your parents curated the music that now prevalates your life and the music you've created.
Wow. Well, you know, Panama is a very interesting place because it's located in Central America. But if you're Black and you live there, chances are more than likely your heritage is Caribbean, because a lot of people from the Caribbean migrated there to build the canal. So there's a lot of Trinidadians, there's a lot of Jamaicans. And that was definitely part of my upbringing musically. So I grew up listening to everything from Willie Colon and Ruben Blades and El Gran Combo to Sparrow and Bob Marley and Arrow, a lot of soca, a lot of dancehall, a lot of reggae. And even, you know, Panamanians, for some reason, we have this admiration for Haitian music. So a lot of compa, you know, and of course, soul, Stax, Motown. You know, my dad was more into music than my mom. He wasn't a musician by any sorts, but he had a collection. and his younger brother had an even bigger collection. And he was the selector for all the family events. But once I was of age, well, first of all, I started playing records since I was 2-3 years old. So I've been playing records literally my entire life. And once I was of age to reach the turntable, I became the 4-, 5-, 6-year-old playing the same records that I was growing up on at the family gathering. So, you know, everything from Otis Redding to Sam Cooke to Aaron Neville to funk, you know, Rufus Thomas, you know, even, you know, the 70s disco era, like all of that stuff was part of my upbringing. And, you know, I know we're going to get into hip hop and everything, but a lot of my foundation, even with breaks, you know, records that I stole from family members to make doubles of, you know, between my dad and my uncles putting two copies together before I was able to go buy records. Like, these are foundations for me, you know. Yeah, I mean, I was all over the place musically.
Now, that's wonderful. And I think one of the things that we tried to get across, I mean, we did an episode on, we called it the Mowos, as a play on the Mobos, which was the music of white origin, to kind of showcase that as me and Chris, we're not just hip hop fans, underground fans of hip hop. We like other music, from, you know, Hall & Oates to I don't want to say like David Guetta, but, you know, just eclectic sounds of music from the 80s, 70s, Elton John, Phil Collins, Genesis, etc. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that helps us, because through the journey of rap, we go to, you know, we go through these realms of music and we learn so much. But speaking of foundation, this is a more of a personal question for me to understand as someone who's elder in the culture and someone who has done so much within the culture. That rich history that you got from your parents in terms of your music and the palette that you had access to, how have you taken that on as a parent and in your child? Because I've got a small child and I've got records behind me and I'm trying to go, how do I, rather than getting Frozen on vinyl or Lion King, what do I do to get into Tribe and how do I create that? So how have you tried to make that transition yourself?
As a parent?
Yes.
Well, yeah, I do have two young daughters. One's a teen, they're both teens now. One's, you know, just became a teenager and the other one is college bound. I mean, they were born into it the same way I was born into it. I tried to rear them musically since they were in the womb, you know, putting headphones against my wife's belly, having them listen to Stevie Wonder, like, you know, and I think I did a good job at that. But obviously, when you become a teen, you get your own, you know, musical palette and things that you like. And, you know, I can't push too much the things that I want them to listen to, but they have the foundation. You know, my oldest daughter at one point was able to recognize a production by James Brown or Prince or Stevie Wonder. If, you know, even if they didn't record the records, like if they heard, like, I remember one time I played my eldest, I Can't Help It by Michael Jackson. And I said, listen to the music, listen to how it sounds. Who does it remind you of? She was like maybe 7 years old and she said Stevie Wonder. And I was like blown away, you know, but I did my job. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, after a certain amount of time, you just have to let them be and grow into their own. You know, my eldest right now is into K-pop. K-pop is like huge globally, internationally. I personally don't really get sure. But you know what I'm saying? Our parents didn't get why we like what we like. So, you know, I can't be too judgmental. She could be into other kinds of music that I'm not really a big fan of. And, you know, it's cool.
Yeah.
It's all good.
No, yeah. In the womb, we did the same thing, try to play the kid. I remember playing Liberian Girl because that's one of my favorite Michael Jackson songs, period. I think Rock With You is a favorite, but Liberian Girl's slowly creeping up, just the way it builds, just the whole song, and not having any of it. M.O.P., how about some hardcore? Yeah, no problem. Kicking around. Any gangster rap music, she was active. Anything mellow, Marvin Gaye, some Bob Marley, no, nothing of that. But anything gangster rap, oh yeah, I'm up for that.
My mom was telling me that she was directing a choir when she was pregnant with me. So my start is in gospel music. She's like, yeah, that's, you was born into that, literally. I was directing the choir, you were in my womb.
Amazing.
Wow. So yeah, nice. That's a nice little anecdote. So Mr. Spinner, I'm going to call you Mr. Spinner. That's the level of my respect for you. Talk about that moment when you're like, okay, I'm a DJ. This is what I want to do with my life? I know you've talked about this in other interviews, but for the benefit of our new listeners, explain that transition into becoming a DJ and some of your early equipment.
Wow. Well, first off, you know, I was aspiring to become a DJ quite early. I mean, I grew up, I'm a 70s baby. I grew up, you know, heavily influenced by block parties, heavily influenced by what I heard on radio in the 70s. You know, I basically experienced the infancy of disco mixing and putting two records together, even before scratching was a thing. And then once the breakbeat culture and early, you know, signs of hip hop in the streets, in my neighborhood, whatever I heard on early vinyl. I mean, one of the first records that completely blew me away was Grandmaster Flash's Adventures on the Wheels of Steel, which is like the first DJ routine ever recorded, you know, and he was using the current records of the time, like Good Times and Another One Bites the Dust, you know, Rapture by Blondie, and just going crazy with it. That was like, can you imagine, like, you never heard anything like this before at a time when hip hop was still on the verge of becoming what it is today. And, you know, you're like, how is he doing this? How are DJs even mixing? How are DJs even putting two records together and transitioning from one to the other seamlessly? So all of these things encompass my urge to become a DJ. And I was the kid watching anytime there was a DJ present in any setting, whether it was a block party or a family gathering or whatever, I stood by the DJ booth. I'm talking about like as a 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 year old. And the first time I got a pair of turntables, I was 12. And they weren't 1200s. They were SLB 303s. They were S-Arm belt drive turntables. So that's what I learned on. They weren't even direct drive. And I had to, you know, the slip mats weren't a thing. So you had to cut plastic and paper and album covers, whatever you had to do to make that record slip and slide. Put in coins on the cartridges so they're heavy. You know, I did all of that stuff. And the mixer that I had, well, I had one mixer and somehow that one went out of my life. It was an early Gemini 2, just a regular 2-channel. But the one that I really, really learned on was a Gemini that had no fader. It was a rotary. It had up and down sliders, and it had a rotary. That's why when I cut on my right side, I can't cut like this. I cut like this because I was cutting up and down. That's how I learned to cut up and down. So when I cut, I'm cutting with the fader like this, not the, in the traditional sense, because that's how I could never break the habit. But that also trained me how to play dance music because I had a rotary mixer pretty early.
Okay.
Didn't really use it much in 85, 86, 87, but because cutting was, you know, was a thing to learn at that point. And I also practiced a lot. Like I made tapes. I made practice session tapes as early as 12, 13, 14 years old. And by the time I was 13, I played my first ever party actually in Panama. It was a backyard party in Panama. And then a few years later in the basement on the block with my homies, just doing, you know, house parties in the hoods, you know, inviting neighborhood friends or whatever. So I got my training organically, I should say.
Dope.
Just by watching. No one taught me. I learned by watching and observing and studying.
And that's important. I think, you know, not to speak for everyone, but I think we all have stories here about the importance of just watching and observing, like trial and error. Trying this, right. This don't work. Oh, it works that way. I think that's dope. Talk about, you know, you're now the DJ making that transition into producing your own music. Because obviously I find the best producers are always DJs or were DJs.
Right. So what a lot of people don't know about me, I have mentioned this in interviews, a few, not too many though, is that I was also trying to be an artist really early. Like I had a group, my first hip hop group was called the Top Choice 3. Back in the days when, you know, you integrated the number of the people in the group in the name of the group. Like that's how far back I go trying to get on. And I'm talking to like 85, 86. And I was going into recording studios that early as well. So 14, 15, 16 years old in Brooklyn with my friends trying to make demos and get signed. I had managers early, different iterations of groups, which eventually morphed into the Jigmasters. But it all started really, I started really young trying to, and, you know, obviously the first time I went in the studio, I didn't know what I was doing. It took me years to really understand what producing was all about. I didn't man the machines myself. I had my ideas. I had records that I wanted to loop up. I would go in the studio and just tell the engineer, here, this, take this part, especially when sampling became a thing. The first time I went in the studio, loops, like sampling wasn't a big thing yet. It was really still like during the days of drum machines, like the Oberheim DMX, the Sucker MC's drum machine was the first drum machine I ever touched. And I still have those demos. And I was rapping.
What was your name?
I don't know if I should say.
You can share. If
it makes you feel comfortable.
Okay, but my rap name was my DJ name. So I went by, for the record, I went by DJ Dynamite because I was a huge Good Times television show fan, like JJ. So I just named myself Dynamite. But I always hated my voice. Till this day, I hate my voice. I don't even like hearing my voice on playback. It irks me, but
I'm the same.
I was rhyming before my voice changed because of puberty. My voice was wild high when I, you know, at that time. And I continued to rap all the way up until, you know, before Jigmasters cut their first record. I was still writing rhymes and spitting bars on demos. So I have, there are some demo tapes floating around with my voice on it. So I had, you know, I had both sides. And I feel like even though I'm not on the mic, it definitely helps me in production because I can hear patterns and rhythms verbally. Like I can spit rhythms in my head even if there's no words, and I can help a rapper out, an MC out, on how to place certain things, certain, you know, in certain ways, take words out so that they fall on the beat rhythmically. I still do that till this day. Sometimes I gotta help some cats out in the booth.
Okay. So you mentioned Jigmasters. I will jump forward slightly, just slightly, and then we'll jump back again. Talk to us about Dwight Willacy, meeting him, and the Jigmasters demo that you guys did for East West with the three of you.
So Dwight was never a rapper. He actually, he was my college friend. And I connected with him because I was doing all of his fraternity parties, Greek fraternity events, in while I was in school. Uh-huh. But once we both left college and I started the Beyond Real label with Krim, he was an integral part on the promotional side because he was already linked. As soon as he left Binghamton University, SUNY Binghamton, he went straight to the labels and he was working for East West Records. And that was kind of our, you know, the bridge. There was a third member though. Actually, yeah. Jigmasters started out as a four-man crew.
Oh, wow.
Yep. If you can ever find the Herb magazine that we were in, there's an Herb magazine where when the magazine was still big before it shrunk, we had there's a guy named Chino in LA, legendary hip hop impresario. He now owns a restaurant, but he used to write for Herb and he wrote us up. He wrote up, a little review on our demo tape because we were shopping demos like from like 91, 92. And then it came down to four-man crew. Was me, Krim, Ammo, and Boss. Then Boss left, and it was me, Ammo, and Krim. And Ammo is actually Krim's uncle, not far apart in age. And then Ammo left. He was trying to pursue a solo thing. And then it was just left with me and Krim. I'm curious as to how Dwight's name even came up in this conversation because he was never. Do you know Dwight?
No, I don't. I understand he wasn't a rapper, but I also know that he was someone that you went to college with, helped the promotional side. There was a sense of community with you guys. I know about Club Scandal as well. I'm not going to ask you about memories from Club Scandal, but it was more to understand. Like, it's more about like nowadays we get to a place where people are very closed off about the things that they know and the and people that help them, and we can't help you. And, right. and whereas at that time when you were growing up, when you're coming through, you, Krim, G-Man, rest in peace, like all you guys were helping each other. So if someone was on the promotional side, if someone was on the email side, if someone was going, I've got the promo side, so that's a really good thing. So I wanted to bring Dwight's name up in terms of going, this is very important that there were people that were helping each other get to the certain place. Right. Everyone had different goals and whatnot, but everyone wanted to get everyone to a certain place. So
exactly, it was, we were a pretty strong team and in a really great time when independence was, you know, being an independent artist meant something. You know, shout out, rest in peace, G-Man, and also shout out to Dwight, who is still in the music industry as a national, you know, promoter working with major artists at Atlantic Records. He's still doing his thing.
Dope. Talking, let's stick with labels. I heard a rumor that you almost signed to Correct Records. You were supposed to do a deal over there.
Yeah, so Correct Records folded right as I was finishing my album. And that Correct album is what became Heavy Beats Volume 1 on Raucous. You know, with some adjustments, you know, some tracks were removed, revamped. But yeah, that's the story of Heavy Beats. It was basically shopped to Raucous and they signed it on.
Okay. So was it going to be like a full-length album? Because you said that songs were removed.
Yeah, that was the plan. You know, the Correct album at the time, some tracks were just beats. They didn't have any rappers on it and no MCs on it. And then once we got to, once I got to Raucous, Eminem was actually a suggestion because he was already kind of linked in with Lyricist Lounge. And then we ended up doing two other records with M because he had a relationship with Scam, who is from Old World Disorder, who is also Krim's cousin.
Okay.
Yeah, that's that connection right there. But yeah, and then Missing Links had somewhat of a connection with them because Al Tariq was also
on Correct Records.
On Correct.
That's right. That's right. So, okay. I love that.
And here's, here's another tidbit. That Missing Links track was mixed at Masters at Work studio. I know that's another conversation. It's another branch of this conversation, but yeah.
This is why we save extra time for people like you, Mr. Spinner. This is why. I love that God Connections album, by the way. That Alter Ego album is crazy. I was listening to it last week. Before I hand over to Summit, I just want to get a nerdy question off, because we're liner notes freaks. Like, we like to know where the songs are recorded, who did what. Tell us about the vibe of the Thingamajig Lab. And do you have any memorable stories from some of those recording sessions?
Man, so many. I mean, so many people been through there that I didn't even record with, man. Like, Posh came to my spot a few times. Q-Tip came to my spot. Like, you know, and Dia Davenport from Brand New Heavy sat in front. I mean, that's where I recorded the song that I did with her. Like, that, to me, that was a moment, because that first Brand New Heavy's album, I played that joint to death. Like, I love that record. And I think she's an amazing singer. Her voice is incredible. And then we had this connection. And she came, like, just so many people. So, I mean, I can't even. Just, you know, there was a point in time where there were so many people coming through there that I had to kind of fall back and revamp my entire life, because it was like a D&D just in my house. Dudes smoking, drinking, you know, I basically hardly had any like private time. You know, I was cranking out beats. I mean, between 96, 97, 98, 99, I was a machine, like nonstop, cranking, going. And, you know, I needed to revamp a little bit. I needed to get a little, you know, quality time for myself. And, but just great memories, man. I can't really pinpoint anything, you know, specific, but just so many heads came through there, man. Ed OG, Master Ace. And of course I moved locations. It was always a thing of Music Lab, no matter where I went. Pharoah and Mr. Complex, they grew up together. So him in my presence back in the days was amazing as well. You know, he's one of my favorite MCs. I tell him that every time I see him. He's one of the greatest. So many people. Like, yeah. Just crazy.
Great name for a studio, by the way, the Thingamajig Lab. When I saw that, I'm like, I want to go there. Yeah. I want to go there.
Do you know, I'll be honest with you, it's very British. That's a very British thing. Like, if there was like someone who kept, like, I could see that somewhere down like Somerset, like a studio in Somerset, where someone's going, oh, it's the Thingamajig Lab. How did you come up with that? Ah, it's just to them. Like, it's so great. It speaks to our sensibility as British people, which is why we love it. How did you manage, like, how did that creative process, but also the time management? So you were going crazy, machine, churning out so much, and then it stops. Like, how did you deal with that as an individual, and what kind of step did you take to do that? Because once you know, when you're in a habit for so long and it stops suddenly, it can feel like about cold turkey. So how did you deal with it?
Well, I think what happened to me, it also coincides with where my career path led, from being this guy who was so immersed in the underground hip hop world and community. And by the late 90s, things really changed drastically. You know, there were so many, you know, artists putting out independent 12 inches to the point where I felt like it got watered down. You know, everybody could get a home studio and cut a record. And then a lot of the pathways that allowed for this independent movement to really thrive started to dissipate. You know, we had a lot of, you know, radio, we had events in New York that hosted a lot of these, you know, independent showcases for artists to really do their thing. And, you know, I would say it's safe to say that the Jiggy era really took over. You know what I'm saying? You had a lot of artists on the underground that was trying to come up top to the mainstream and started making records that sounded more like what was going on the radio, to sell records. And I guess from a business standpoint, it made sense back then, because when the market became saturated in the underground, there was no other place to go but that way. You know what I'm saying? When Raucous got down with Universal and started trying to fit into that major label mold, that was pretty much the end of the independent era the way we knew it. So for me, I wasn't appreciative really about where hip hop was going in that mainstream world. And I got bored because I felt like I had done so much, and I felt like I was ahead of myself even on the production side. And much like Dilla, you know, I bring Dilla up because he also was very ahead of himself. And there was a point in time where, believe it or not, people were not gravitating towards his production as much as they should have. Mm. He was churning out incredible beats, you know, having meetings with certain labels, certain artists, and people weren't biting. And I don't think it's his fault. I just think it's the way the industry went, the direction that, you know, artists went in. Luckily for him, he had alliances with some major artists like Busta and, you know, Q-Tip and Tribe and Badu, etc. I didn't have that for myself. But here comes the UK, me traveling to Manchester with the Fat City guys, going to London, linking up with Pete from BBE, and going to 333 and, you know, hanging out with Giles Peterson and checking out just the UK scene in general. Really was, it was a mind-blowing thing for me. Because, and then Phil Asher, rest in peace to my brother Phil Asher, my first experience ever in London turned out to be a great one because of the late great Phil Asher. Because the first time I came out there was for a show with Krim, Jigmasters, and it was a whole bunch of other cats, Craig G, FT, it was a whole bunch of dudes. But that show didn't pan out. We weren't taken care of properly, and we were kind of stranded. So Phil Asher put us up. And I bring his name up to say he put us up for a week. Didn't really know us, right? But he introduced me to that entire West London broken beat new jazz scene. He took me to Global Distribution, which was closing at the time, which I guess became Goya or whatever. But I collected all these early Broken records, and that was a brand new thing. I never really heard of this stuff before, and it just opened me up. So I'm saying all this to say, I'm, you know, a little long-winded, but I'm saying all this to say that my life change and going into other genres of music was necessary for me to be where I'm at today, respected internationally on different musical scenes. That trip and those trips and just traveling in general to Europe, Japan, and especially the UK, it just opened me up. So I was like, man, there's no turning back. I got to stay in this space. If that meant some hip hop would be sacrificed for my output, so be it. You know, I'm always going to love making beats, but, you know, and I'm actually getting back into it now. You know, in my head, I want to be the way I was in the late 90s. Life doesn't really allow me to be that way time wise, but in my head, I'm there. Like, I'm ready to go. I'm ready to go hard again. It's a good time for it.
When you have family, it's one of those things where your mind goes, I'm ready. I want to go. Body goes, nah, you gotta go to sleep. Like, you can't do it today. Like, I'm ready. Like, I'll be like, Chris, I'll do 3 documentaries, no problem. Give me a week. And it's like, yeah, bro, I'm tired. I was up all night. You can't do it. But it's a good segue. And Chris, before I hand over to you, it's a good segue because, you know, in the late 90s, I think 99, correct me if I'm wrong, you do your first, you put out your first house, I guess house single. A product, but it was interesting that doing the research, I was like, oh yeah, but there was the song on Freed's records that you guys did that was in the compilation. I just thought it was a nice way of the stars aligning that, you know, yes, you went to house, you know, it's documented that you went to house in the, you know, mid 80s. House is massive. It's the same thing here, you know, hearing you talk about house music and going to shows and house music shows back in the 80s, it's the same here. A lot of those DJs back in the day used to play house and then turned into hip hop or went different ways, or they used to play. But Pete Tong, massive, massive dance head and revered in that scene, used to play hip hop. Like, on a Friday, it was a big thing, and he just chose to go with that dance route, which is absolutely fine. So it was just really interesting to hear that, and the connection with Freeze Records was a nod, because, yeah, Todd Terry, you know, Freeze, we did the documentary on Jay-Z, and we delve into the Freeze bag, and it's interesting.
Might I add, the since we're speaking on Freeze, yes, we Jigmasters did have a track on a comp, but then the Everybody Bounce record, Rude Rhythms Experiment, took off. The bounce, I mean, that was like the groundbreaking record for me. Groundbreaking, like it was a club banger, still is to this day. I heard Funkmaster Flex play it at a concert recently, and it blew the place apart, like, you know, almost 30 years later. But that was my official entry, where I was able to, it opened up the doors for me to run into labels and get more work. And Todd Terry, so one of the studios I went to as a young teen, in 87, I was like 16 years old, Todd Terry, this is a Tony D studio in Coney Island, and he was mixing Jungle Brothers' first album. So okay. I met Todd in 87. I got a crazy story to tell you, actually.
Go ahead.
So met Todd then, and I had to remind him of that connection at Tony D's in 95, around the time that I was hanging around Freeze Records a lot. And after that Bounce record blew up, he gifted me his SP-1200 here. So that the SP-1200 that's in my possession was what he did all those like early, like Royal House, I'll House You, all those early house records that he created. That's what he did it on. And on that machine, there was a sticker going across it that said Todd Terry still rocks. I took the sticker off. Took the sticker off because it's not Todd Terry's machine. So fast forward a few years later, Kenny Dope and I are really close friends, right? And, you know, everyone pretty much knows by now that Masters at Work Todd Terry, they're all interconnected. He's part of the family. He's probably the reason why Masters at Work exists. But Kenny and I developed a really great rapport. He's like my record sensei. He has every record in the world, bananas. We went on a digging trip to Portland, Oregon, in like 98. And we're in the hotel chilling. And I told him about my SP1200 experience with Todd. And I said, yeah, there used to be a sticker on it that says Todd Terry still rocks. And he looked at me. He was like, yo, you know who made that sticker? I was like, nah. He said, I made that sticker. I was like, wow, this is crazy. Full circle.
That's mad.
And the way your
voice, Kenny Dope. The way your voice changed amazing
when you said that as well. Like, yeah, I respect it. Yeah, Kenny Dope is amazing.
Oh, amazing, man. Amazing. Oh, my God.
Wow. Full circle.
Sensei.
We can cut right there.
Yeah, I mean, no.
No, we could keep going.
Mic drop moment. One of the reasons, like I said, we've wanted you on this show for such a long time, but someone put the battery in our back last week, a friend of yours, Jay Live. And he wrote a tweet and he said, you can't talk about the 90s indie scene and not mention DJ Spinner. And I felt that because I agree. When I first heard the rule of Allah is God's equality, desire for my brothers the same as I desire for me. When I caught the acronym, it activated me, Mr. Spinner. Like, it set me on this path, like, to find out more about history and just myself in general. I need you to talk about your relationship with Jay Live, and in your opinion as a DJ and a producer, what makes Jay Live so special as an MC, and how does it speak to your chemistry with him? Because you've never missed together. You and Jay Live is like Aki and Saltfish. You know what I'm talking about.
Well, he's slick, he's intelligent, and he's also musically inclined, because he's the only dude, at least for back then, that I ever saw rhyme and cut at the same time, which I don't understand. I don't see how anyone can do that. But besides all of that, I think that he is one of the most intellectual rappers. He doesn't get enough credit to me as one of the greats. You know, even if he's not the super mainstream artist, he is incredible. He's an incredible artist, and he knows how to put songs together. He knows how to conceptualize songs and albums. Very, very smart dude, man. And slick, you know, and also one of the pioneers of indie rap. Because I met him right after Bragging Rights, right after it. And that Bragging Rights record was pretty massive for the scene. For the movement. It was big. Mm. It was big. It was a big record. And I ended up remixing it. You know, shout out to my brother Jock Max as
shout
well.
Shout out to him.
Shout out to him. Another unsung legend in the game. Who also helped me at a time that I really needed it, because he lives in Kansas. He lives in Kansas, never lived in on the East Coast. He's a Midwest cat. Met him buying records. And on a humble, just looking for records in Kansas, I was out there because of a past relationship with somebody, female, that I was dating at the time. And anywhere I go, I'm looking for records. So someone told me, come back. I went to one store called Seventh Heaven Records. And the person who worked there said, I don't really know about old spots, but you should come back the next day, tomorrow or whatever, and get with this guy, Thomas, a.k.a. Jock Max, because he knows all the spots. Linked up with him. Then he took me to his basement and played me these incredible beats. To me, and then he had the group Basement Chemists, which I'm sure you're aware of, right? Mm-hmm. And we ended up, BRL, we ended up putting out some singles. He was on a few compilations with the group. But I always felt like Basement Chemists were kind of like Slum Village before Slum. Mm-hmm. And if there was an album slated, it never panned out, then the group broke up. And they also had a demo deal with Elektra Records. After Jigmasters got their deal with East West, I got them their deal, a demo deal with Elektra. And, you know, that also, it fold, both situations folded because Elektra East West became one label. And, you know, a lot of the staff was were let go and, you know, our projects just fell to the wayside.
It's interesting because you've already answered my next question. One of our listeners, shout out to 12 Original Players, he was like, make sure you ask DJ Spinner about that Basement Chemist situation. So I just want to clarify, you say there was an album slated. Was it recorded? Like, because there's a rumor that there's this unreleased Basement Chemist album.
Yeah, there pretty much is. So the plan was, you know, to take the songs that were recorded for Elektra and merge them with the singles and the stuff from the comps, and that would have been the album. But right now, it's just sitting on ADATs. The tapes need to be transferred, and also the group needs, they need to work out whatever, you know, because I don't really know internally what happened with them. But, you know, they would need to work that out before it comes out so that there's no beef, no issues. You know, I know they're all amicable and they get along, but, you know, there's something going on there that I'm not aware of. So that would need to be worked out. I'm not really...
you're not privy to that.
Need to know all of that. Makes sense.
Exactly, yeah.
Because people are asking.
Because people come for us in the streets. You see what I'm saying, Mr. Spinner?
Didn't ask about that record. What are you doing?
Yeah, yeah. We'll do like a two-hour interview with someone and they'll be like, but you didn't ask them about this. I was like, did you just...
Leave us
alone.
Listen
to the rest. Yeah, anyway. Chris, I think we should get into some songs if Mr. Spinner has some time. Yeah. Very, very briefly.
You got time. Yeah.
You got time. All right, so we're going to go into fan mode now. Like, I've got a list of songs here, Mr. Spinner, and it's like a quick fire round. You can just share a memory or a story about the song, how it came about, how you feel about it now. It's on you, essentially. You're our guest. Number one on the list, one of my favorite remixes of all time. Stakes is High, DJ Spinner remix. Oh my God.
Yes. Yes. So I got a letter in the mail from Tommy Boy. In, you know, 95, requesting my remix services. I wish that I kept that letter. Maybe I have it, I don't know. But that was a life-changing moment for me because obviously De La Soul is the greatest hip-hop group of all time. Changed my life. Super fan. And that was the second remix that I had ever done. Das Effects was the first. And I was in Kansas. I was transitioning between Kansas and New York, and I had to get it done. So that's how Jock ended up becoming part of that remix, being a Dome Crack. We started the Dome Crackers together. He came up with the loop, the jazz loop, chopped it up, sent me the disc, went back to New York, took the disc, arranged it, reprogrammed the beats that he had going, and I added all the little sprinkles and spacey things that I, you know, used to put in my beats. And the rest is history. And that record, the thing about that record for me, it was a blessing and a curse. Blessing because it's a De La Soul remix. It thrusted me into like notoriety with a major artist, a group that I, you know, highly revered, legendary, but it was only available in the UK.
Come on.
In the US, it was a UK import and hard to find and a little expensive for a very long time. So I was like, damn, it's dope, but the UK gets the best of this. And, you know, cats over here couldn't really get their hands on it. So in a way, and I wanted to be recognized for the record here, but fortunately, it got released on a remix EP, Super Sweet Steaks Baby, I think it was the name of it, which had For More, Steaks is High remix, and maybe one other track. Maybe you can pull it up.
I've got it on a compilation called, like, it's Remixes and Rarities. It's got a green cover.
Exactly. It was on that as well. But for vinyl, it came out on the Super Sweet Steaks Baby And it was also edited. So the long version is only on that UK version.
Come on.
And it's a collector's item because it's also orange vinyl. And that was kind of hard to get too, but not as hard as the UK pressing. But I'm grateful for it because it connected me with De La Soul, their friends. Rest in peace, you know, True Goy to Dub Dave. Yeah, I mean, it's one of my most favorite remixes and accomplishments for sure. De La Soul, having my name on a De La Soul record. Big.
Yeah, I remember when I first heard that remix. So when I heard the doom 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 doom, I'm like, nah, DJ Spinner's too much, too much. The next song, shout out to one of our followers, We Stay True Records. He wants to know about the Verbalize remix, Big Kwan. He calls it a lesson in programming.
Yeah, I saw that tweet. I saw that. I went crazy on that record. I mean. Yeah. I was influenced really with programming drums the way I do from Pete Rock. To me, Pete Rock is like my OG spirit animal. You know what I'm saying? Like Marley Marl and Pete for me are the fathers of my hip hop style, I should say. I have a lot of others that I admire, but when it comes to my thought process, Marley Marl is the godfather for it all. Like, he's the godfather, period. And, you know, Pete obviously came up under Marley. But that funk, it's about the funk, man. That remix, Verbalize, is all about doom, 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 doom. And the snares and all that stuff that I was doing with that, that's my Pete Rock influence on that.
Dope. Dope, dope, dope. Talking about godfathers, we have to salute the god, Sadat X. God is back.
Yes.
You see that beat, yeah? If I was a wrestler and I'm coming out at WrestleMania, I might play that song as my entrance theme. The God is back.
Yeah, so that record was crafted. Sadat had gone through some things. He had a little hiatus and on his return back to the game, Peter Gaston, he was signed to Peter Gaston's label. I'm forgetting the label right now.
Was it Female Fun?
Female Fun, right. And Peter Gaston and I had been working together for some time. He actually shot the Till the Day video. No, the Sadat X video, actually, that we did, Don't Get It Twisted. So that was our connection, one of my early connections to Sadat and Peter Gaston. And I was like, yo, he's working on an album. I got the perfect joint for him because he's a God body 5%er. And I was like, man, what's better than the God is back in town? You know what I'm saying? Like, it just fit the whole narrative for him at the time. I just thought it was a good match to flip that. And there's also a double whammy with that because the sample that I used was used by Large Professor for a common remix of Resurrection. I just chopped the shit out of it and reflipped it.
You know why that's crazy, Mr. Spinner? You know when I said Stakes is High is one of my all-time favorite remixes? The only remix I put above that is Resurrection Extra P Remix.
Well, that explains why you like that beat. Because
wow. I didn't know that. I never knew that.
Never knew.
I'm just gonna put it out there. I did not know that.
Yeah, you got to go back and play both now and put them side to side, and you'll see what I did.
That song is amazing. You know when Sadat said, "All my five fingers complete the whole hand. Live every day as the years proceed." People often gas me. My poor heart bleeds. I love that song. Sorry. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, we just let you know this is a Sadat X appreciation society. Yes. We love Sadat X. Oh my God.
I've done quite a few records with him, man.
You have.
He's a special breed of MC right now.
Yes.
There. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, 100%, 100%.
A couple more songs. So these are friends of mine who are on this song I'm going to mention. Constantly Growing for Braille featuring Sojourn. Sojourn is a friend of mine. We've done songs. You look a bit like you can't remember it.
Yeah, I gotta I remember the title. Yeah, please play it because
Hold on. It's
a bit of it's a rarity. Summit's gonna pull up. Whilst he pulls that up, let's talk about good music for Master Ace and Edo G.
Yep.
Love that song. I love all your songs.
That is a joint that, if I remember correctly, has no samples.
You had no samples on that?
Yep, only the drums. The kick snare. Yeah, there's no
You, sir, not from this planet. Yeah. I've as the process has gone, I've realized that you're like Black Thought. You're not from here.
This is wild behavior.
You know what else has no samples is the 7XL joint. No samples.
Grand Poobah and Seminolik.
Yeah. No
silly.
Samples.
You're silly.
That's all played. I played the sounds on the little Casio CZ1 and resampled the keyboard and chopped it up, but there's no samples in it.
You gotta behave. You gotta behave.
You're not from here. You're not from here. You, wherever you transported from, go back. AI's taken over. Go back.
I want to visit that place and come back for a minute.
Yeah. Now, good music. Good music is dope.
I do have Constantly Growing, so let's play that.
Okay.
We constantly grow. The people we know. Constantly grow. Mind, body, and soul. Constantly grow. Good and evil goals. Constantly grow. We reap what we sow. And constantly grow.
Grow or die. The dichotomy of cacophony of mediocrity. Monotony. Gets pawned off as artistry. Fronting on your fans. Come on, yo, honestly. Why you even bother, B? You better off being who you ought to be. So part of me, as I outgrow this pottery, roots run deep.
Yeah. I remember that. I do remember that. That's one of those that I wish I actually tracked in person. That was one of those beats that I sent, and it was recorded and sent back to me. But that was during my MPC 3000 phase.
And the thing is, Sojourn asked me to ask you, what did you use when you made that beat? And you've answered.
Yeah, that's strictly MPC 3000 and some, of course, I can't reveal what I sampled, but yeah, that's the spinner sound right there.
Absolutely. The last song I want to ask you about is a song I used to sing at work. I used to walk through the office just humming this song, Butterfly Girl. Eric Robeson.
So Butterfly Girl was the production was me and Tikla, aka Victor Axelrod. And you probably know the record Days Like This by Sean Escoffrey because it's a huge anthem. But it's the same guy who played keys on playing on that Butterfly Girl. And that was another great record to work with Eric, because I think Eric is another one of those legendary artists, and to have him on my album was kind of a big deal back then. And I ended up doing something for him shortly after that. I guess you can call it a swap. He had a record called Couldn't Hear Me Over the Music, and I did The Answer. I couldn't hear her. And he transformed that. It's a really simple beat, but he transformed it into this epic, timeless journey. It's like an 8-minute track with a crazy solo guitar at the end of it. It's mad. So I have two tracks with Eric under my belt. Well, three if you include, I did a remix for DJ Kemet out of Atlanta, Kemetic Just and Justin, Fortune Teller. So there's three tracks that I have with Eric's name attached to it.
Amazing. My cup is full. I'm just so happy we got to speak to you, man. Seriously.
We're saving some things for part two one day.
Yeah. Okay.
Because we've still got
there's questions.
If we're honest, we've still got another 6, 7, maybe 10, and we could roll off that. We're professionals, Mr. Spinner. We'll leave Rude Rhythms to another time, all that eclectic. Okay. I like to dive deep into I like Cruz. I love Cruz. We came from Posse Cuts, and I love DJ Cruz, and there's not enough of that, and I want to learn about this person, that person. the stories that we get is what makes this the show that we and for the listeners, this is what it is. So
yeah, I got things. I have things to say. So whenever you're ready, man, just
you got something. He's got some things to say, bro.
I'll give you one more. So Dead Man's Walk on the B-side of Beyond Real, which was the first Jigmasters 12-inch that we put out, that was originally a posse cut. It was like 5-6 minutes long with a bunch of dudes on it.
A bunch of dudes that we know of?
Nah, you wouldn't. Yeah, you wouldn't really know them. It was our crew.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was originally a posse cut. We just condensed it, and it's just me and him.
Have you ever thought about putting out like a DJ spin of Lost Tapes? Because I get the impression from you that you've archived all this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the closest thing to that I've done is unreleased beats. You know, I'm pretty sure you may have seen some of those. Yeah, 97, 98
love
beat
them.
Tapes. But yeah, of course, man. I have some, you know, a lot of tapes that have to be transferred. But yeah, there's tons of material sitting around, a lot.
Yeah, let's definitely do a part two because I want to get some Polyrhythm Addict stuff.
For sure.
Open. Absolutely.
No.
Absolutely.
We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Spin.
It's a pleasure, man.
This is a bucket list. Yeah. Honestly, him, he's like, you know, I can be cool, but he's just like, you know, he's like, you're spinner. Like, it is, you know, I fell short here because he was like, I want DJ Spin. I was like, yeah, no, I'll reach out. And either never got around to doing it or went the wrong route. And then he was like, yeah, I'll go DJ Spin. I was like, okay, thank God. Because for him it was a wonderful thing. And honestly, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. I think, you know, you're a legend for a reason, not only for the work you've put in, but for the person that we've spoken to, a very calm, cordial, very, very nice person. I'd love to have like a coffee or a bit. I don't drink, so it'd be a coffee or something.
Me neither.
Like a tea. We'll have some tea.
We'll have some tea.
But no, it's been honestly, I can't begin to say, like, I've loved this conversation.
Yeah, me too.
And thank you very much for your time and for your wisdom as well.
My pleasure, my brothers. Thank you for having me. Let's do it again, man. I'm down.
For
definitely.
Sure.
Peace, brother.
Peace.
Thank you.
Peace.
Well, that's that was, I don't know what to say. I feel like it was almost like a dream. I didn't expect the conversation to go that way. I think, what a guy. Like, I always look at things and go, like, and when I'm speaking to someone, I'm always looking and going, we know the work, we've heard the work, but this person is connected to almost everyone in the game, is heavily respected across the world. Why is that? And I'm like, oh, now I get it. Because when you talk to him, you just go, what a nice guy. Like, what a nice guy. Like, he's so chill. Rough. And he's happy. He gave up his time, gave up his wisdom. He wanted to give us stories. Like I feel like there's a reason for those listening. When you're trying to almost not role models, but when you're looking up to people, look up to people like DJ Spinner, because you really truly get to understand why the talent is one thing and it's super incredible and it's super top tier. But him as a person, you can get along with him. You can work with him. He's easy. And I love that. And that's what's going to bring success to anyone working in any type of entertainment industry, whether it's the podcast industry, whether it's the music industry. So, you know, that's a life lesson for all, man. And I know you're happy.
No, definitely. And I want to thank, I hope I pronounce her name properly, is Keetia.
Mm-hmm.
When I reached out to DJ Spinner through his website, she was the person that got back to me.
Wonderful.
Very professional, very prompt. Just want to say thank you so much. Appreciate you.
Yeah, we appreciate that, man. I haven't fully digested that, and I'm sure I will once I listen back to it. But there were some stories in there.
We got to get him back.
Yes. Let's leave some time, and maybe when he's over on these shores, it'll be good to do some in person. Interviews as well. So
now
I appreciate you for setting that up. That's that's one off the list. And peace to DJ Spinner. You'll be able to, we'll put in the show notes, you know, where you can go to his Bandcamp and follow him. But yeah, DJ Spinner, a legend of the culture. As always, you can follow us at Break the Atoms on Twitter and Instagram. Chris's handle is at I'm Kinetic. Mine is at Hip Hop Chronicle. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, peace and love.
Peace.